You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English. Welcome back to LawPod UK after our summer break. I'm here just to introduce our participants. Today we have three guests whose work sits right at the centre of environmental law, a field where international law, government policy, and public interest litigation often meet head on. They are all involved in the Environmental Law Foundation, or ELF, as we'll be referring to it in this podcast. Running the panel will be Richard Wald, KC, who chairs ELF. Richard has appeared in many of the landmark environmental cases recently and teaches environmental and planning law to practitioners across the profession. In this episode, he'll be turning the tables, putting his colleagues in ELF through their paces as they unpack what's already happening in the courts and in government decision-making. First, Emma Montlake, an executive director of ELF. Emma has spent her career bridging the worlds of law, science and policy, helping to ensure that environmental decision-making remains both robust and transparent. While she's been at ELF, it has become a trusted forum for practitioners, academics, and campaigners who specialise in environmental justice and sustainable governance. Alongside Emma is Carol Day, vice-chair of ELF and solicitor at Lee Day, and one of the most experienced lawyers in bringing environmental challenges through the courts. Carol has acted in a remarkable series of judicial reviews, many involving the intersection of public law and environmental protection. Together, they'll explore how environmental law is evolving, what trends they're seeing in complaints and the courts, and whether litigation is still the most effective tool for advancing environmental protection these days. Richard, I'm going to hand over to you now.
Well, thank you very much, Rosalind, and thank you also for inviting us to participate in this podcast. I'm really delighted to be joining along with Emma and Carol. Before I ask Emma to kick off with an explanation of how ELF functions, I thought it might be helpful just to say a word or two of how I myself got involved in ELF. It was over a couple of decades ago that as a junior barrister, I wanted to develop a practice in environmental law, and there weren't many ways of doing so, but ELF was a way of doing so. By taking on cases on a voluntary basis, it was possible for young practitioners, not just barristers, but mainly, as I knew it, barristers to cut their teeth on cases that one would not ordinarily come across. It's been an organisation that's been close to my heart ever since. About a decade ago, I became a trustee, and then 3 years ago, I took over as chair of ELF, and I've seen the organisation grow, develop, and become an even more significant contributor to enabling access to environmental justice. For an explanation of how that functions and what ELF can offer, I now turn to Emma, who has spent, I think, even more time associated with ELF than I have, really right at its coalface. Emma, tell us what your role has been and how it all works, if you would.
Yes, thank you, Richard. So back in the day, ELF used to run an internship, and we used to have about 40 or so environmental law and environmental science students come through the doors, and they would help us to facilitate what we call the A&R service, advice and referral, sometimes referred to by Martin Polden, one of the ELF founders, as the National ELF Service, which I always thought was rather good. We should get some t-shirts made. So advice and referral sits really at the heart of everything that ELF does, and that is where communities can approach ELF for assistance with environmental and public interest matters. And that is the criteria that needs, that public interest is really important. We look to support around 300 plus communities a year. we are reactive, communities come to us. What was established in 1992 when ELF was set up and sits still at the heart of that service is a professional pro bono network where members of the legal profession and indeed the environmental science profession can join our membership and are then situated where ELF can refer matters to them from those communities that have come to us for the assistance. And so we get this amazing sort of joining of communities and lawyers through ELF as an aider and assistant creator at the heart of that. We have over 100 professional members, and we reckon that they give somewhere in the region of £450,000 worth of free legal advice every year. So pretty significant, relatively.
Wow, that is extraordinary.
Yes, I mean, yes.
Emma, you mentioned Martin Polden, and I just wondered if our listeners would like to understand how this organisation first came into being. I mean, he is one of the founders, but tell us how ELF was first conceived.
Yes, well, it's rather a nice story, really. And of course, ELF was set up in the recognition that communities who were suffering environmental harm had no access to either resource or legal expertise or indeed money. So ELF was conceived on that basis, that there was this great gap for communities who were looking to defend their environment. There were three founders, Martin Polden, David Hall, and Diana Schumacher. Diana Schumacher is still with us. Sadly, Martin and David died a little while ago. But I still go and have lunch with the wonderful Diana Schumacher. And last time I had lunch with her, she told me this great story of how her and Martin first met at a health farm. Martin had gone there to lose some weight, and Diana had gone there to get away from her family and have a bit of quiet time to do some writing. Martin, who was quite a colourful lawyer, had been the lawyer to John Lennon in his drugs conviction. He had been working for a developer and had realised, working closely with the local community, that though they were passionate, they had no resource to defend the landscape and the nature that they loved. So he was in this sort of place already where he was feeling, oh, there's a real injustice here. And then he comes across Diana at this health farm. Now, Diana is one of the leading environmental campaigners of her time. And it must have been the most extraordinary conversation. I can't imagine the sparks that must have flown. And a few years later, ELF was formed and really very much does today what it did. 1992 was when ELF was set up. So their meeting was a few years earlier. And it took them a little while to get off the ground. But I remember actually reading about ELF in the Times at its launch, really making quite big headlines because it was this completely new organisation doing something completely different that nobody had done before, and it was filling this gap for environmental justice for all. We don't do an internship anymore, but we work with universities. So in terms of that sort of educational role that ELF always played, that is still maintained. We have now a network of something like 20 universities that we work with. That's clinical education and also policy clinics. But just to go back a little bit to the advice and referral, I mean, we see a huge amount of different inquiries. The spectrum is so wide, as I say, as long as it's public interest and environmental. And that includes loss of green space, problems with protected sites, and a huge amount of planning matters. Obviously, our planning system is well tied to environmental regulation. And so we see a lot of matters that come up through development.
So, Emma, give our listeners a flavour of the sort of cases that have come over your desk in recent months and years. And then perhaps give us a sense, sitting as you do at the turnstiles, of the issues that affect communities within the environmental law sphere, of the sorts of cases that are increasingly coming your way, or what you see the future holding in that sense?
So I picked out three really great cases that I was very pleased to be involved with, and we had some success. The first of those is a case in Molly Grove in Pembrokeshire, where local people became increasingly concerned over the impacts of marine recreation, such as co-steering, on a very beautiful secluded bay, which was a triple SI in the national park and also within a special protection area, which really gives it about the highest protection you could possibly imagine. And they started to take video recordings and collect evidence of this disturbance. A couple of years ago, they were highly alerted and alarmed to note that a planning application for a marine hub had been submitted in Molly Grove. And whilst there were no environmental reports whatsoever on the application, when the local people came to us, we immediately saw that there would be an increased recreational impact on this bay through the development of the marine hub. And although it was 2 miles away, we got in touch with the national park and said, really, there needs to be a habitat regulation assessment here. And they accepted that that was the case. A habitats regulation assessment was undertaken, and we argued at that instance that it had been undertaken inadequately, but that was to no avail, and approval was given. Now, we worked with this community. They were so passionate about the wildlife, and they were having a really difficult time. The applicant was not easy. But what happened after that, which is just such a brilliant story, well, certainly for me anyway, is that the matter got taken up by Wild Justice, Chris Packham and a couple of others. And yeah, they were successful in their judicial review of the permission. And I love that story. This is a truly passionate community, really fighting against the odds to look after the nature that they love so much. And in swoops Wild Justice and takes the matter to the court. So that was a really good result for everyone involved.
I'm keen to get Carol into the discussion. She's got some hot off the press news involving Wild Justice that I'm sure we'd all like to hear about. But just very briefly on the other case or cases that you wanted to mention.
Yeah, so that was a case where we got involved pre-application and it was seen through by another organisation. Just another case briefly was a massive quarry in Northumberland in a place called Kirkwelpington, where they had waxcap grasslands, which denotes very ancient soils, which will be destroyed by the quarry development. In this instance, the applicant, the local authority, hadn't screened for emissions from the disturbance of the soils. We pointed that out to them, and in that instance, they consented to judgment. In other words, they conceded that the permission had been taken illegally. It was such a nice case, that one. We worked very closely with Plant Life and also got to learn all about waxcap grasslands, which are just fascinating, beautiful, beautiful mushrooms. I think the last thing, I'm not going to go on about the other case, but I just wanted to mention something. Certainly, we are seeing quite a few cases which are taking advantage of the Kent Finch case that I think Carol was very much involved with. And that's interesting. That's all about downstreaming emissions and actually having to take account of those emissions rather than just ignore them. That's a case that we have had recently. Sadly, we don't often see inquiries come through the door about waste crime, but we're starting to see a lot more of that. Agricultural land, which is being used by owners to hold, take in huge amounts of waste without the necessary permits, and sadly, a lack of enforcement over that, and local people really, really suffering the impacts of unregulated waste disposal. With the Environment Agency, quite often there may be some investigations going on, but it's so slow. Yeah, it just leaves local people and local wildlife in a real mess.
So, Emma, I wanted to ask before I invite Carol to tell us about a very recent case. What are the challenges that you have seen facing communities that wish to take, for example, you gave the example of polluters, but any environmental law claim to litigate if that's necessary? And how are those challenges best addressed as you see it?
I think for communities, really, the big struggle is costs. When they want to challenge a bad decision made by a public body, their only option is to go through the courts with that and judicial review or statutory review. Despite our cost capping rules, which Carol can talk to, it does remain an enormous challenge for local communities to get the funds together to challenge things that are in the public interest. And we remind ourselves that this is not about private gain.
So let me turn to Carol then. You mentioned Aarhus. It's obviously absolutely core to ELF's work. It's the UN convention to which the UK is a signatory. It, amongst other things, provides access to justice in environmental law, although the small print of that bears careful reading and sometimes careful fighting in order to defend it. Carol, even less than a week ago, there was an important judgment, was there not, of the High Court that grappled with the scope of cost protection that one can obtain through the Aarhus Convention in the UK. You were involved. Tell us a bit about it, if you would.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to, Richard. Thank you very much for having me on this podcast. I'm delighted for the opportunity to chat with you and Emma. This was an amazing case, actually, and a really far-reaching judgment. We've already heard a little bit about Wild Justice, actually, and the work they do, but it was a case brought by both Wild Justice and the Badger Trust. And they were very keen to challenge some licences for badger culling that had been granted by Natural England in 2024. And those licences had been granted against the advice of Natural England's own scientific advisers. And their feeling really was that they had been granted to maintain the confidence of the farming community rather than really the purpose of protecting the spread of disease. So they lodged their claim in August of last year. They got permission in May of this year. And then in August of this year, Natural England applied to the High Court to increase the level of their caps, their Aarhus caps for the case. So you mentioned already the Aarhus Convention. It's a really important convention for us because one of the major aims of it is to enable people to bring cases to court at a level of cost that they can actually afford to do it. Before we were a member of the convention, it was incredibly difficult to go to court. You were pretty much walking in with an open checkbook. I remember when I was working at WWF, we took a case in Scotland, which we lost. It was about a funicular railway at the side of a mountain. And we were slapped with an order for costs of £200,000. Now, that does not go down well with your trustees when you're a charity. And so obviously, a lot of smaller charities, all charities, in fact, were prevented from going to court because of the threat of legal costs against them. Now, there'd been a lot of international concern around that. There was a complaint lodged with the European Commission. There was a complaint lodged with the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee, which all took about a decade to crunch through. But then in 2013, we got this new bespoke cost regime for environmental cases, which meant that if you went into court as an individual, your adverse costs, now those are the costs that are awarded against you if you lose the case, were capped at £5,000. So you knew if you walked into court as an individual, the worst that you would get for adverse costs would be £5,000. And if you were a charity, you know, whether that's Friends of the Earth or RSPB or Wild Justice or whoever, the figure was £10,000. So that enabled you to then fundraise for that figure and to know exactly what your cost liability was going to be before you went into court. So that was a real step forward. So in this particular case, Natural England had applied to increase both the cap for Wild Justice and Badger Trust. Obviously, there was £10,000 each, so they were liable for £20,000. They applied to increase the Wild Justice cap from 10 to 20 and the Badger Trust cap from 10 to 30. So they would have been liable overall for costs of £50,000 had that application been successful. The judgment that we got was incredibly important. The judge said he had no hesitation in dismissing the application, which was great news. And the judge looked at two different issues when he was doing that judgment. He looked at the very sort of close financial position of those individual groups. Both of them have got very small members of staff. You know, most of them are funded by donations and run by unpaid volunteers. And he said that in this particular case, those organisations couldn't afford any more organisation, any more finances. For Wild Justice, it would wipe out half the money in their bank account. And for the Badger Trust, they had adopted a policy, which is recommended by the Charity Commission, that you have money in reserve so that if you get a fall in your donations, you've got some money to fall back on. Now, Natural England's increased cap would have meant they had to dip into those reserves. And the judge felt that was unreasonable. They shouldn't have to do that.
And the magic phrase in the Aarhus Convention is the litigation shouldn't be prohibitively expensive. That's what guided the judge, is it not?
It is. And he said for these particular organisations, an increased cap would be prohibitively expensive for them. But the part of the judgment that he made, the really insightful comments, I think, is actually not that part. It was actually, he has a second question he has to ask, which is an increase in the cap reasonable for those groups on an objective basis? And in that, he looks at the importance of the case for the environment, the situation of all of the parties in the case, whether it's a viable claim. Lots of different factors go into the mix for that second part of the question. And it was in answering that question that he came out with some really, really helpful comments of importance for this whole costs issue. He said that in this case, the claim was viable. It had been granted permission to proceed. He said it was a paradigm environmental case. So in the sense that nobody had economic interest, there were no local residents with housing prices that might have been affected. It was literally a case totally in the public interest. He also said that the group's arrangements for fundraising, they'd lodged a crowdfunder, they'd raised about £50,000 in 5 months. He said all of that was eminently reasonable, nothing there to criticise. But one of the most important things he said, and this is really interesting for organisations that do take legal actions, was that you don't just look to see if they can take that particular case. So, you know, if they furtle under their mattress and come out with an extra 10K, can they pull all their money together and cover that case? He said that environmental interests of that type play such an important role in protecting the environment that they should be able to, in a sense, repeat litigate. They shouldn't take a case, go bust, start up again. They should be able to do more than one case because what they're doing is protecting the environment, which is something that is a responsibility of everybody, and it can't represent itself in court. So therefore, these groups need to be able to go to court to speak for the environment. And it's really important that a judge makes those sorts of comments about the role that these groups are playing in environmental law. He also made another really interesting point about the role of regulators. And he said, well, look, Natural England is a very large body. It's several millions of pounds worth of funding. It is going to get judicial reviews against it. And the importance of that is that it really improves the quality of decision making within environmental regulators. And that therefore, the likes of Natural England should actually almost in a sense expect that this is going to happen. And it's the kind of judge on their shoulder. It will improve the ultimate quality of their decision making. And again, he felt that it was in public interest for those cases to be brought forward. So lots of really helpful commentary in that judgment.
A powerful judgment, I suppose, from a judge whom you would expect such a judgment, who spent his career bringing judicial reviews against bodies such as that, but very helpful. And it's not going to appeal. Is that what we understand?
Well, I guess we probably need to wait a little while for that because the judgment was only handed down last week. So I'm not sure. I'd have to check whether the deadline for them to appeal that has passed or not. But there was a very interesting blog that they posted. Actually, you know, sort of, I think it was just after the judgment was handed down, where they said that they probably felt they wouldn't be doing this again. So my feeling is they may well not appeal this judgment, but I would need to check on the time to make sure if we're definitely out of that period.
Okay. Can I just ask you a few other questions about the Aarhus Convention? You've told us a bit of its background. I understand that there's a meeting, an important meeting of the parties to the convention, the 8th meeting, that's coming up in a couple of weeks' time, 17th of November through to the 21st of November. Tell us a little bit about what that is and what we expect to happen at the meeting of the parties and why it's important to anyone involved in an environmental battle here in the UK.
The Aarhus Convention, I mean, probably very few people who are listening to this will have heard of it. It isn't concerned with big charismatic megafauna, and you know, we've got the climate COP at the moment. It doesn't have that benefit to it. But it's a very important strategic international agreement because it really protects how democracy works. And we've talked about the access to justice provisions, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But for things like access to information, I mean, the sewage scandal in this country was uncovered because people were able to ask questions of their local water authorities, and those water authorities were compelled to provide that information. That's another key part of Aarhus. Another key part is people's involvement in something like the planning system. So it's engaging in how decisions are made. So the convention sets minimum baselines for how these really important environmental rights operate, not just in the UK, but all the way across the UNECE region. So, as I say, even though it slightly flies under the radar, it is actually really important in terms of people's campaigns and fights to protect the environment.
So it's not just about cost protection. The case that you've talked us through, the Badger Trust case, is about cost protection, but there are other aspects, are there not, to the convention? And now you've mentioned a couple of those.
Yeah.
Access to information is one of those.
Absolutely.
And participation is a third.
Exactly. And there's a couple of other which are really of incredible importance. I mean, the central part of the convention, the Article 1, is a right to a clean and healthy environment. So the right of every single one of us to breathe clean air, swim and drink clean water. And it talks about the rights that exist for future generations. So we have to think about how this is going to pan out for people, you know, our children and grandchildren in years to come. So there's a really important central component of the convention. Also, another very controversial and current part of it is protection for environmental defenders. And we've seen some incredibly draconian provisions of recent laws in relation to that. So, as you say, pivotal rights around the right to know, the right to engage, the right to challenge, our right to a clean and healthy environment, and the right for people to go out and protest about environmental matters. So, yeah, very important.
And the meeting that's coming up in a week or so's time, what can we expect the UK government to do at that, and with what effect?
Yes, I mean, it's a very interesting question. The UK, in previous meetings of the parties, we've always been part of the EU. So it's been part of a central decision-making block, and decisions have been made as the UK, as one of the EU. This will be the first time they're actually operating almost like an independent party. And we've already seen how that might play what they're going to do. In previous years, the UK has always adopted the reports of the Compliance Committee that have gone to the MOP. They've always been a sort of a very respected central key player that has said that they will sign up to what the Convention Secretariat is recommending. This year, we have a question mark about how that's going to operate. So we have a report that's going from the Compliance Committee to the MOP as a central body on this issue of legal costs. Now, normally we would have expected the UK to have endorsed that report by now, and it hasn't done so, which is very worrying.
The MOP is the meeting of the parties.
Yes, meeting of the parties. We hope they are going to endorse it before the MOP, which, as you said, only starts in 10 days or so. I'm going to that, and I'm going with a colleague from Friends of the Earth. So we really would hope that we're going to see that report being endorsed before or at the MOP.
A bit like the European Convention on Human Rights, both instruments have become something of a political hot potato. There are those that argue for the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from its involvement in both. Could you say a few words about that? Where do you think we're going in terms of continued involvement in the Aarhus Convention?
That is such an interesting question in this period leading up to the MOP. We've had a lot of negative press, as you've said, and it's quite difficult to pin down where that's coming from. There was an article placed in the Daily Mail, actually written by Keir Starmer himself, which I thought was extraordinary. He made several quite personal attacks on people who bring these cases, and also about the role of judicial review and the UK's membership of the Aarhus Convention. And we've seen those reports at a fairly low level continuing through the year, but slightly being ramped up as we approach the MOP. And as I say, we don't know where they're coming from. We had a great answer to a parliamentary question some 10 days ago now where the UK said they have no intention of withdrawing from the convention. That's really good news. But as I say, that narrative in the press combined with the kind of growth mantra that we have from the government is very worrying. So we are slightly nervous about whether there may be further changes to judicial review. We had a review, I think it was last year, undertaken by Lord Banner, in which he made one or two suggestions about how review could be speeded up because of the government's concern about the amount of time it takes for nationally important infrastructure projects to get through. Those changes have been implemented. We don't really see there being scope for further changes without taking us more into breach with the Aarhus Convention. So we really hope that there is no truth to that behind what the UK press are reporting, and it will be very interesting to see the position that the UK government adopts in the MOP and whether we see those key endorsements as I mentioned earlier on.
Is that meeting you're going to in Geneva? So is there anything that can be done to push back on that narrative, that emerging narrative of negativity about Aarhus rights? Or in other words, how in the longer term can those Aarhus rights be protected or defended?
Key question. And I mean, obviously, I think we need to push back very strongly on those individual environmental rights. And I think because they do slightly fly under the radar, I think all of us, you know, whether that's individuals, groups, community groups, we need to be really making sure that people understand the importance of these rights. And I think looking a bit more at that central Article 1, right to a clean and healthy environment, it's something that has been slightly overlooked, you know, by the UK and by other people. So I think taking a longer term view around that right to a clean and healthy environment, possibly also around new emerging concepts like rights of nature, for example.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about rights of nature. Either you or Emma, do you want to say a few words? Because it's an area that ELF is increasingly interested in, is it not? Tell our listeners a bit about what's meant by rights of nature. Emma, yes.
So for me, rights of nature is the last bastion of hope. I'm sorry to be overdramatic about that. We are seeing such a terrible fall off of nature, and we are live in one of the most nature depleted countries in the world. It's time for a paradigm shift, and I think where ELF would position itself is that we need to redefine how we think about the natural world, moving from a place of resource and ownership and exploitation to one of understanding, kinship, partnership, even with the natural world. I would say ELF's been working very closely with a local group in Lewis, Love Our Ooze, regarding the rights for the River Ooze. And in February of this year, our local authority, Lewis District Council, made the remarkable decision to support and champion those rights. So whilst we can't say at the moment that the River Ooze has legal rights, we're starting to define our conversation around the river, though that will embed itself in responses to policy and planning, along with those rights, such as the right not to be polluted, the right for its own native biodiversity and the right to flow. All the things that the river needs to thrive and to be restored as a living, thriving river. So yes, it's a really interesting area of law for ELF to be involved with. It's very exciting. We're right at the forefront of that and that new way of thinking about redefining our relationship with nature.
Thank you, Emmett. It certainly is interesting. It's work that ELF will continue to be involved in, no matter the progress of the defence that it wages against any attack on our Aarhus rights. So both of those areas will increasingly be important to the work of ELF. I want to mention another area that has gained in importance for ELF, and it's interventions. Emma mentioned, when discussing the origins of the organisation, David Hall, one of the three founders. And we have at ELF an annual memorial lecture. This year, it's to take place on December the 11th at 6 o'clock. It's happening on the top floor of my chambers, which is 39 Essex Chambers, on Chancery Lane. And the topic this year is one that is of increasing interest and importance to ELF. It's interventions. And we have four really very excellent speakers coming along to each give us a different perspective on intervening in litigation by parties such as ELF. Those speakers are Carol, I'm very pleased to say, that will be giving the perspective from the solicitor's profession. Carol's been involved in a lot of important interventions over the years. Katie Dekawa of Friends of the Earth will be giving the NGO perspective. David Hart, King's Counsel and a former chair of ELF, will be offering the perspective from the bar. And then finally, Kate Tandy, who is head of litigation and casework at the relatively recently formed Office of Environmental Protection, will be offering the perspective of the OEP, an organisation like ELF that is increasingly interested in intervening in key cases that raise issues that are relevant to its ambit. So I turn back to Carol, if I may, just to ask briefly if you could explain What is the process for intervening in a judicial review? What does it look like? And how do organisations get involved in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to flag, I will be talking about some of the cases that Lido has been involved in interventions, as you say, Richard. So really interesting cases around the definition of waste and farming. So a case we did for River Action, also another sort of the interpretation of the Section 245 lure duty on national parks for CMP, and also an intervention we did for Wildlife and Countryside Link in the recent Supreme Court case of CG Fry. So there are lots of good things we can talk about. But in terms of how the process works, it's a front-loaded process. And so it's quite simple in the sense that you make your application, and that can be at any stage. That can be in the High Court, that could be in the Court of Appeal, or as I say, with the CG Fry case, it could even be at the Supreme Court level. You basically make your application, but you have to put everything into your application in terms of the points you're going to make. So as I say, that's why it's front-loaded. And it's a slightly tricky line to cross in the sense that you want to be able to be saying something relevant to the case, but you don't simply want to be repeating the points that the other parties are making, because obviously you need to bring something, some sort of additional perspective or insight or expertise to the court. And that's really what, as an intervener, you're trying to do. You're trying to bring some particularly specialist experience or expertise to benefit the court in reaching a judgment on the issue. The judge can grant the intervention, and he could say, or she could say, that it would be an oral intervention, in which case you can make oral submissions before the court. It might just be a written intervention, or sadly they may refuse. But increasingly we tend to see that the judge will at least grant permission for a written intervention, which is very helpful.
So I'm going to turn back in a moment to Emma to ask for some examples of where ELF has historically intervened, and the sorts of areas where it might be looking to intervene in the future. Before I do that, Carol, can I just ask, what are the risks and benefits of an intervention? What does one need to look out for? And why would an organisation like ELF be prepared to take on any such risks by intervening?
Well, the main benefit is exactly what you just said, really, Richard, which is the opportunity to make good law, you know, to help the court, to assist the court in making good law. And the opportunity to do that, sometimes when you haven't had the chance to bring your own case, but an opportunity can arise and then you can sort of, you know, seize on it and use that opportunity to make your points that you want to bring to the court. The main risk is costs. And at the moment, as a result of legislation that was passed in 2015, the situation about your exposure to costs as an intervener on behalf of the claimant is quite confusing. We saw that as soon as that legislation was passed, the number of interventions in the next few years, literally probably less than a handful. But that seems to be slightly changing now. We have seen more intervention applications coming forward more recently, largely because the court has not relied on those provisions to make people exposed or to expose interveners to a heavy degree of costs. There is a little bit of good news on that, actually. One of the things the government has agreed to do as a result of this international concern around costs is to clarify the level of costs that interveners will be exposed to, which, as I say, is confusing at the moment. And they have already said that they're going to run a consultation on that, and probably the level of costs that people will be exposed to as an intervener will be less than those of the Aarhus cap. So it should be less than the £5,000 or £10,000 caps that already exist. So hopefully we have in the pipeline some good news in that in the future.
I was going to ask, I think it follows from what you've said that interveners are not able to avail themselves of the benefit of cost protection contained within the Aarhus Convention. Is that the case?
Yeah.
And are they excluded because they're not a claimant in the judicial review, but they have a different status that takes them outside the regime?
Yeah, I think it's just the way that the regime is constructed, is that it applies to the party that's applying for the case and the defendant. That caps are spelt out in the civil procedure rules for those parties, but they're silent on interveners. You're quite right. I should have pointed that out, Richard. It's just one of those areas where it's just not covered by the CPR.
Now, Emma, can I ask you, when has ELF intervened in the past? If you're able to comment also on that issue of costs, how the risk of costs has been managed in the past, and what sort of cases is ELF on the lookout for in terms of future interventions?
We were approached to see if we would intervene in the Manchester Ship Canal case. And as Carol has already alluded to, the beauty of an intervention is that you can, as a third-party organisation, bring up before the court other matters that perhaps have not been covered. So in the case of the Manchester Ship Canal, whilst this was a private canal run by a private company, the case being about the discharge of illegal sewage into the Manchester Ship Canal itself, the more national perspective on sewage pollution and the impacts both for communities and the natural world was not covered by the proceedings. So ELF was able to bring a sort of national perspective to what was going on with the sewage in a more general way. That case was about nuisance and trespass and whether the Manchester Ship Canal Company could actually bring a claim for nuisance against United Utilities, which up until the point of the Supreme Court judgment had been a resounding no. The advantage of the Supreme Court judgment was that it accepted that nuisance and trespass as common law could be brought against United Utilities. So that was a great case to be involved with. We dug into our communities to get as much information from them as possible as to the egregious impacts of illegal sewage discharge.
So that was a successful intervention. How was the risk of costs managed in that case?
Oh yes, well, actually we were fortunate in that case to be supported by the Good Law Project, and in fact the solicitors acted pro bono. We had to be very clear for ourselves that there were going to be no cost implications for ELF as a small charity. And that was indeed the case. It's good news to hear that there's going to be some clarification brought to the cost regime for interventions, but it is just a brilliant way for organisations who have something to say and something important to say to get involved in environmental litigation in this way. And indeed, we are being approached now by different organisations as to whether or not we might think to intervene where ELF has something relevant to add to the litigation.
So I'm going to jump in here, having been quiet during most of the discussion, because I have a question for you whilst I've got you captive on LawPod UK. It's a particular interest of mine, and indeed we've done a couple of episodes on LawPod on this particular subject, which is the welfare and protection of our food animals, farmed animals. So my question for all three of you is, do you have to be a wild animal, like a badger, to come under the Aarhus costs, information and intervention rules? Or does the welfare of farmed animals come within that? And I'm thinking in particular of the litigation going on or being crowdfunded now in order to judicially review the lack of enforcement of animal protection regulations in respect of non-stun slaughter of animals that is happening.
Well, thank you, Rosalind. That's a very interesting question. So far as the cost protection aspect of it is concerned, the Aarhus Convention limits itself to so-called environmental judicial reviews. That has given rise to a bit of debate and a bit of litigation as to what qualifies as an environmental judicial review. And a little over a decade ago, there was a case called Venn, in which a claimant in a judicial review challenging an extension to a residential building next door, sought Aarhus cost protection and got it. The High Court and the Court of Appeal both held that that did fall within environmental judicial reviews, somewhat to the surprise of practitioners, because it left the ambit of such protection so wide, including most day-to-day planning cases. The example that you give would fall outside the world of planning, most likely. And I'll turn to Carol, who'll give an insight as to where we are on those sort of non-planning types of case and cost protection.
Yeah, it's a very topical question, actually, Rosalind. It's something which is being examined, you know, as we speak. We had a judgment from the Court of Appeal. It arose from a case that had been brought by an organisation. At the time, it was called Global Feedback. It's now changed. It's Foodrise Limited. And it was a case originally concerning the UK-Australia Free Trade Agreement. And it looked at the issue of greenhouse gas emissions that might arise as a result of that FTA. So the actual provision being challenged in that case wasn't an environmental provision, but it did have environmental implications, and particularly for the minister who had to consider the Paris Agreement as part of addressing the relevant question. We had a judgment from the Court of Appeal that was an unhelpful judgment in a sense, because basically the judges concluded that if the provision that you are challenging is environmental in nature, that will make it an environmental case. But if it isn't, sadly, cost protection will not apply. So I think it would depend whether the provisions the claimant in that case is seeking to challenge, if they are environmental in nature or not. Now, that's a topical issue because we've just heard that, in fact, the claimant in the Food Rise Limited case has now got permission to appeal to the Supreme Court on that point. So we will, in due course, have the consideration of the court, the full Supreme Court on that issue. So it's not a completely closed chapter, but a very topical one.
Thank you very much for that. It's a live issue. I'm glad I raised it.
It's a live issue and it illustrates the bumpy road that has been Aarhus cost protection over the years. I just wanted to say, Rosalind, that if any of your listeners or listeners to this podcast wanted to know more about the organisation, ELF, then we have a very good website that will tell you more, that will tell you how to become involved, should you wish to, either if you're a member of a community facing environmental issues locally and you want help in understanding how to address those issues, or if you are, for example, a junior lawyer wanting to get some experience in working in environmental law cases, or if you are a person wishing to support the organisation in any other way, the website is a very good first port of call. But we would love to hear from you, and we would love to see you at the David Hall lecture on the 11th of December if you are interested in hearing a bit more about the topical subject of interventions. With that, I'll say thank you very much to our two speakers and to the podcast for having us all on.
I must say it comes as a bit of a shock that our Prime Minister has been negative about Aarhus in the press. It's so important now that the natural environment is under such pressure that it should be represented in court. I just remind listeners that all the cases referred to in this discussion, I will put out the full citations, the cases, in our short blog piece on the UK Human Rights blog that accompanies this podcast. So thank you again, and hope to see you again on LawPod UK in the future with perhaps better news.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.